Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited. Welcome to Education Suspended. So glad you're joining us. I want to begin today with a special shout out for my daughter. It's her birthday tomorrow. She's turning four. And while I fully acknowledge she is not listening to any of these episodes right now, maybe someday she will. So happy birthday, Quinn. Some of you noted that you noticed Quinn has joined our team this year and have heard her little voice at the end of our episodes. But for today, we're going to move her to the front just to put an extra smile on your face. And listen, I know I've said it before, but it doesn't matter how long you've been in education. The minute you become a parent, it just feels different. And that urgency, right, that drive, that fire to change the system grows beyond tenfold. And so we're doing what we're doing to try to make it better for the next generation. Anyway, again, happy birthday, Quinn. I love you. All right, enough of that stuff. Let's move into today's episode. We have an amazing, amazing conversation with Dr. Gooden. He was so inspirational. His story, not just his own personal story, but his own story as a middle school teacher and how he's used those lessons from his students to change the system are just fantastic. He highlights how we must maintain a sense of curiosity, being courageous, being committed day in and day out. He talks about the importance, even though it's uncomfortable, of just acknowledging and feeling and allowing the resistance. We're in such a crucial state. And I was so grateful for his time. I also just loved his connection to lessons that his mom taught him about how with opportunity comes obligation. So with that being said, sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Dr. Gooden.
Have a good day at school. Stay kind and curious.
Good morning, Jessica. You got a sick partner.
Well, I've known that for years.
Yeah, well, I know. I didn't really need to say that. But I will be carefully muted so I don't cough into this program.
Sounds good. All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We all would like to have your resonant voice. So.
Oh. Well, thank you. I keep looking for that radio announcer job, but no offers have come yet.
I think one's on the table, Dr. Gooden.
Okay. Well, let me know. Let me know where it is, Steve.
I love it. Well, it's so nice to finally meet you. We're excited to have you on our podcast. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Nice microphones, by the way. Those are like really professional setup. I'm impressed.
Yeah, don't be too impressed.
I was just going to say, don't be too impressed. We haven't changed any settings on these darn things since we started using them. It's merely for show. But don't we look so like top notch?
You do, yeah.
Well, good. We just want to look like we know what we're doing.
Half the battle, right?
Yeah, half the battle. Exactly.
You look
exactly.
Good, you play. My grandson says, you look good, you play good when I take him golfing.
So I love it. I love it.
Well, let's jump in. So, Dr. Gooden, we start all of our episodes the same. We will have you introduce yourself to our listeners, talk about what you do, how you got there, and then we'd love it if you would reflect on your own educational experience as a student. And what connections does that have to what you do now? And then we'll go from there. So we'll just hand it off to you. And yeah, we're excited to learn from you. All right. Awesome.
Well, good morning. I'm Mark Anthony Gooden. Currently, I'm a professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. Specifically, I'm the Christian Johnson Endeavor Professor of Education Leadership. Also, one of the authors of 5 Practices for Equity-Focused School Leadership. In addition to teaching, I also go outside the institution and do keynote speeches and workshops on this work. Usually, I give keynotes about broadly anti-racist leadership, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, but also tangential components of that work around things like unconscious bias. So very excited to be here today and talk to you a little bit about my journey to get it to this point. I should say, thinking backwards, I've been a professor for, I always have to pinch myself when I say this, but 22 years. I teased my daughter. I said, well, you know, some people thought I was just 32. And look, I've been doing this since I was for 22 years. So she never agrees with that, by the way, but very excited about the work. I actually got my start in education as a secondary mathematics teacher in Columbus, Ohio. I guess I should go back a little bit further. I actually was one of those folks, like a lot of undergraduates, who wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, you know, when I grew up. And it was getting to be where it was a little scary because it was my junior year and going into my senior year, even I was still unsure. And as a mathematics major and as a part of my fraternity, I got the opportunity to tutor some kids in mathematics. You know, it was just the basic one-on-one sitting at a table with some students, going over some geometry and algebra with them. And as a result of that conversation, those kids ended up saying, you know, this really did help me improve my grades. I went from failing to now having like a B plus and thinking one case, maybe an A. And I thought for a moment, like, wow, maybe I should think about doing this full time. So as a result, I still had time in my senior year to take a couple of education courses, which was suggested to me. And that was really great because that changed my pathway to go into get a master's at a mathematics education degree. So I was leaving my home institution, Albany State, the college at the time, and graduating with it. That's an HBCU, which is an important part of my learning and development, and going to the Ohio State University, Go Bucks. So I got a chance to go there and work on my first master's in mathematics education, and subsequently went into teaching, which I've just described as a middle school mathematics teacher in Columbus, Ohio. And that was just a great opportunity to learn and to engage with kids. And one of the things that impacted me then was having questions about how to interact and engage with my kids in a way that connected with them. And it was a school where it was, I would say, 90 to 95% African-American, working class parents, people who really wanted to give their kids opportunities through education and wanted them to love and enjoy and engage in school. And so it just presented an opportunity for me to learn with them as a very young teacher. And my kids would remind me all the time that I was the first Black man they had seen as a teacher. And I always thought, nah, that can't be, you know, like, you know, then this is eighth grade, surely. And other kids in the class said, no, I've been in class. We've been in class together. And we're pretty sure you're it. And even then, I was the only Black man who was a certified teacher in the classroom at that time, which was Southland Middle School. The other Black man on the staff was the principal. And then there was also a gentleman who worked with the students with disabilities, but he wasn't a certified teacher at that time.
So this wasn't initially on my radar, but I am wondering, right, you were talking about just this component of representation and, right, these stories from these students that were saying, oh, you're the first Black teacher, and not just that, but the first male Black teacher. And I think I'd love to dive in just for a second. We know that in general, especially right now, the retention of teachers is difficult. But I think it's safe to say, even before our present moment and the impact of COVID, the retention of colored teachers has been difficult for years. Can you talk a little bit about like the systemic implications of why that exists? Like what is going on that our capacity to retain really strong teachers of color continues to be a challenge?
Wow, very good question, Jessica. So, and I don't want to oversimplify this problem, but I've taken a couple of different takes over the years. And over time, there are some consistent issues with this. You know, one, just generally, teaching, in my opinion, hasn't become easier. I mean, I think that's the first thing. And even though it hasn't become easier, we have created these spaces where we not allow teachers to grow and develop, but we've created even more opportunities to be critical of them while somehow managing to keep their salaries pretty depressed over long periods of time, right? So when you think about that combination in general for teachers, credentialing and some of the difficulties around it, I think that impacts people going into education. Generally, recruiting and retaining great teachers is just difficult. But there's some other nuanced issues that really challenge the thinking. So I'll just give you a couple personally that I think really, even though we're talking, you know, 30 years ago, it still connects today. So for instance, when I first took those two education courses, I was surprised to find that in my intro to education course, there was a lot of conversation about whether teaching was a profession. I said, what is that about? And there was this debate around teaching being a semi-profession. I said, well, so why are we having that conversation? And so it was this idea that, yeah, it's not really it's not a job that you work 12 months at, the salaries are not necessarily competitive. And so I found that there was this particular bias in teaching that hasn't gone away, because it was a profession that was, a large group of women went into the profession. So I felt like there were these gender dynamics that was, I never heard anything like that when I was on the track to be an engineering major, or to be like, even if I was going to do this really exciting career of actuary scientist, which somebody introduced me and I said, no way am I doing that. To me, when you raise questions about something being a profession or semi-profession, you can more easily push against this idea, well, should they really be given a better salary? Which I think is absolutely problematic, right? Then you take folks who once they've gotten an opportunity to go to get access to education, we find a lot of, Black folks, not all in this country, really have, and we can talk about the legacies, having slaves, ancestors, and not having access to economic opportunities, having multiple layers of discrimination over the years. And so when you think about that, and you finally get the opportunity to go to school and get a four-year degree, and you say to your folks, hey, I'm making just about what I would have been making if I hadn't gotten a degree at all. They said, wow, that's not what we were expecting. And your family needs you to, hopefully be able to support, but you're finding you're struggling to support yourself. And it's not an exaggeration to say that teachers in some locales, I'm originally from the South, and the salaries, although there are states who become a little more, I think, crafty at this, they'll start at a higher salary. But if you look at the salary over time, it's more or less like it goes just a little bit above a plateau. It's not like you're getting the kind of increments that you would get. So imagine that you're coming from a place where you may have student loans, or you may have family members who might be dependent on you because of historically how inequities work. And then you're not making as much money after you have gone to get your education. And you might even have some debt on top of that. We found now, to tie this to the research, a lot of, people of color, and I'll just say Black people in particular, find that, yeah, when I came out, I may have been interested in starting an education for a period of time and thinking about maybe if I could move into leadership, it would be better. Or I could think about other ways to support my family. And this has actually come home very personally. I have a younger cousin who started teaching, and he and his wife, both teachers, they have three children. But for a while, he went out and experimented with trying to own a trucking company, a trucking business, and doing a number of other things. But he found all of those careers were economically more rewarding than teaching. Ultimately, I'm glad to say he came back, and he's now considering being a counselor. But he's also very entrepreneurial. He does these other things on the side to really support him and things in the summer, as well. But when you think about all of that, connected with the fact I did this, and I still hear my current teachers doing this as well, you get a very limited budget to buy supplies to enhance your job. Teachers are still going out spending their own smaller salaries to buy things to become better teachers. And then we look at that and say, yeah, that's pretty much okay. That's what you would do. So when you put all that together and say, you're going to be on this trajectory where you're going to make less money, spend more of your money, and then be criticized publicly, isn't this a wonderful career? Wouldn't you want to do this for the rest of your life? And a lot of the younger teachers are like, no, there are other things I can do. When I talk to a lot of younger folks these days, even my mentees in the academy, they remind me that they are of a generation where they may not agree with me. I say that I've been a professor for 22 years. A number of my mentees saying, I'm not sure if I'm going to be a professor for 22 years. I said, maybe I'll do it 7 years, 10 years. Maybe 5 years. I mean, I just want to be open to doing some more things. I want to start a nonprofit. I want to open my own school. I want to use the research. I want to take it to the ground and be more, pragmatic. Not saying that I'm not, but I'm just saying for them, it's there are more things out there that pique their interest, even than doing just this one job. So we have to be mindful that a number of the younger folks coming out these days really are more open to different types of careers.
It's interesting. Your synopsis on that. We just released yesterday our episode with a teacher who left teaching, and she echoed similar things. But I think having that historical lens on just the innate inequities that have existed for Black people, it's a double whammy, right? Like you have that systemic racism and how it impacts them just outside of education, and then to then move into an innate racist system along with the inequities. I think it just, it makes sense, and it's just sad, but it does make sense. Thank you for kind of connecting some of those dots.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm real curious about Mark's own education, how it led you toward this, maybe even as a younger person growing up. I love something your mom said. I think I found it somewhere. She said, you got to balance opportunity and obligation. So if there's a little mom talk in here, I think we'd appreciate it. We both have strong, great mothers, and that's always a good place to jump off from.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you for that, Steve. Yes, I've said in other venues that my mother was my first teacher, right? And I didn't always recognize that as a, you know, headstrong teenager. But over time, I watched as she, even though she, you know, didn't have, I think, a solid salary or large amounts of money, she was always extremely open-hearted and open to giving to people and supporting people. And that's one of the things that she reminded me, that, you know, you can do well and you certainly have an opportunity to take advantage of a number of things. But don't forget that, you know, there's an obligation to support folks. So this philosophy of lifting as you climb, which really, if you read like the work of folks like James Anderson and like the education of Blacks in the South, that was a strong connection to this idea of people who had been formerly enslaved, who didn't have the educational background to make a salary. They made wages, right? And what they did was just so heartwarming and heartbreaking, because society was in this space of pressing down upon them that you can't do this and you can't be more because you are a Black person in this society, and racism is very real and it has all these historical connections. But what they did is they recognized that education was this thing that could uplift their children. And so even though they didn't have a lot of physical means or these, they mortgaged their labor to build schools. And I agree with Anderson's assessment that Blacks in the South were, you know, largely responsible for developing and building and the education system, because they were motivated to do that because they looked at education as this thing, like Malcolm X used to say, education is our passport to the future, but tomorrow belongs to the people who prepare for it today. You know, or education is the great equalizer. They believed that there was no way that their children were going to survive in this racist society without having an education. And so I've heard variations of that all my life. One of my mentors used to say, education is the one thing they can't take away from you, so get your education, right? He was so impressed when he found out my wife and I were going on from our undergraduate degree into our graduate degrees. And he just said, oh my God, Mark, that's so great. You're working on your PhD before you start working. That's so wonderful, because once you get your PhD, man, you're just going to be so in such a better position to be able to help your people. And so it was always that thing of, you have opportunities, but you have obligations. And my first opportunity to really have that lesson drilled into me was, I remember I wanted to get a job at 13 or 14. And finally, one of my father's friends gave me a job. It was like the hardest job I had ever done. And maybe teaching is one of the two, but it was doing roofing work. And I absolutely hated it. It was like carrying shingles. And you know, these things are like 90 pounds, and you would carry, I had to carry these bundles up to the top of the roof on this ladder and give it to, and so the little fiberglass would cut into my neck. And originally I couldn't carry a full bundle. And I remember making my first, you know, week of pay and coming home, and my mother saying, that's really good. And you know what, we've got this opportunity to, you know, support, you know, kind of need you to help out with a bill here. And then I said, oh my God, like I was going to spend this money on this. I was going to save. But there was an obligation, again, knowing that we economically, you know, being a single mother, didn't have everything she needed. And so I was called to help. And I did. And I hated it. You know, I just said, I saw everything I had worked for out in that hot sun, just turned it over. But ultimately, and I say this to my daughter all the time, understanding what sacrifice means, understanding this bigger than you, it's about what you had an opportunity to do. Because a number of folks my other cousins included, were not able to get jobs before they were 16, you know, before they were able to secure a work permit. So there was an opportunity there, and obviously there was an obligation tied to it. So yes, I learned that lesson over and over throughout life in many ways, so that now I don't have to think much about it, but certainly taught me that I can live on a lot less than I think.
Okay, I want to ask a question, and please tell me if it doesn't make sense. It goes back to kind of what we were just talking about previously, which is the retention of Black teachers.
Yes.
It seems to be a little bit of a dichotomy of, as a Black man, you were given the strong message that, you know, education, I think you said, is the passport, right? Your passport in life. And at the same time, if we look at, you know, the experiences of our Black children in schools, we have practices that are really racist and make it hard to even get through the system. So I would assume, and I don't want to be an ass, but I would assume that also makes the retention of Black teachers hard, is that for many Black children, education is not a place in which their sense of self is celebrated.
I would agree with you. Yes, that is true. And I would say a couple of things, that once again, these are the realities of the profession. So yes, I find a number of Black students go into spaces to get educated, and they have not gotten an opportunity to tell that story that I just mentioned about Jim Anderson's work, right? They've not gotten that connection to what the purpose of education was. So a part of my work is I look at law cases, and I look at this idea of how the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment really defined opportunity and limited opportunity for African-Americans, particularly in the South, when we're looking at law cases, right? So what's happening today is there's no through line to that story for young folks who are in school. And they're being told, in fact, that being shown that you don't really even belong in the educational space, right? We're looking for ways to get you out. Or if you are here and you do belong, there's a lot of history that says you're intellectually inferior. Few people are going into spaces saying to Black kids that, did you realize that your ancestors actually, there's a lot of evidence that says they built the education. So why would they do that? Why would they have this Harlem Renaissance? Why would they be so engaged in reading about themselves and writing about themselves and talking about their connections that go way beyond America? Black people supported education prior to us being enslaved in America, but you don't hear those stories, right? I was in a workshop just recently, and this is a little bit of a digression, and I was working, and a person was there from Spain, and she was saying to me, wow, this concept of race in America and how it works, and, you know, from Spain, and, you know, we don't really talk a lot about this, and, you know, this is really relevant, and I just said, you said Spain. She said, yeah. I said, well, do you have anybody in Spain talking about the occupation of Spain for almost 800 years by the Moors? You see, because the Moors were African people. They were Black. And what's more, they brought technologies to Spain that are still there. They brought educational innovations. You can read about the Moors who strategically learned how to build homes so that they could cool their areas without modern air conditioning. And then at the same time, build it so that the wind would come across the gardens, right? And then there would be a little bit of fresh scent there. It talks about how the Moors were preoccupied with really making sure that cleanliness was a big part of who they were as a people. But historically, you get to this notion where there's no connection to young people and knowing what that story is. And I say that to say, there's this person who works, she said, yeah, I kind of heard about the Moors, but that history is lost because we do the same thing in America, because we present a particular aspect to students like, your people don't really value education, or you don't have to value education. No one is surprised if you just want to check out in the back of the room. We're not going to hold you to any standard, because after all, historically, from what we know, you know, maybe there's some fact to eugenics that you can't think so much. And so I think when we do know those kinds of things, what happens is we have folks who come with a preconceived notion about people of African descent and whether they're going to be impactful in the space and whether they're going to really contribute to the educational dynamic. And last but not least, I want us to understand there are inequitable systems that really prevent people from access. And again, I'm going to talk personally here. So here's what I found, what I knew. As a mathematics major, I knew a number of friends who had graduated with me. Again, these are folks with mathematics degree who may not have done so well on culturally biased mathematics tests that tended to, at the time I was teaching, keep a number of Black teachers out of the classroom. Now, here's a question I can ask now that I couldn't ask then as a researcher. What is the correlation between those tests and teachers being successful in the classroom? Probably almost zero, right? Because it's a knowledge test. It has less to do with your pedagogy. It has less to do with how you engage with kids who have been, you know, psychologically suppressed by. It has less to do with that fact that you show up as a Black man and kids are very curious. How did you get here? What did you do? And tell us, how did you make it through the system, Mr. Gooden, right? So I want us to understand that those systems tended to keep more Black teachers out at the time from going into secondary mathematics. And so here's what they found. Look, I've taken this test twice. I didn't do well, but you know what? State Farm said, we'll hire you, making more money with less trouble. So then the teaching professor says, oh, you know what? We were just playing. We're going to come back and offer you a job for $10,000 less a year. Are you still interested? Like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And so that's the issue on the recruiting side. And then even on the retaining side, after they work a couple of years, what happens next? I personally thought this, and maybe I had an ego issue, and you can chalk it up. I said when I came out that I was a master's, I was a Black man with a master's degree in mathematics education. And I raised the question, like, because I went to a teaching fair and I was very popular there. And I said, well, you know, wouldn't it be something that if I could get a signing bonus? Not really interested in athletics or being an athlete. I said, well, it would be nice if I'm in fact somewhat of a unicorn. There actually was a district that offered me a signing bonus. And I thought, why wouldn't we be doing more of that? And why would it sound so ridiculous? But when we talk about athletes, you know, I almost, this is another story for another day. I actually almost went into the military because I thought we didn't have enough money to pay for school. Going into the military, I remember them saying, if once you take the ASVAB and you go into certain careers, they had certain, I don't know if they still do this, they had certain kinds of bonuses that they would pay you to come in. And I just said, why not for teachers? Just curious, why not for teachers? Especially if you say, we're really serious about recruiting and retaining more teachers of color. And it is definitely an issue. You know, she'd be doing that in general, but I would certainly think that you should be doing that for more teachers of color. And I know people will give me pushback and say, that's unequal and that's unfair. But there are professions where we find that there are things that we have to do if we want to change the dynamic.
Mark, as a fellow middle school teacher, when you kind of got through the system and got your first job, I have a feeling those kids taught you a lot about teaching and a lot about life. I would like to hear any middle school stories that sort of propelled you even to where you are today. Because I think there's maybe no better, that's sort of the margins of education. Everybody thinks the middle is where no one wants to go. It's kind of contradictory in terms, but you obviously had a fire. What kept the fires burning?
You know, you've hit on something that I've said, I learned a lot about being a great facilitator and teacher from that middle school experience. And it was tough. It was really, really tough. Speaking of teachers who get pushed out, at the time, Columbus Public Schools is what it was called. They had what was called a PAR program. It was a peer assistance review program. And a number of people said that this also was impacting on the number of teachers of color who were leaving the profession because they couldn't make it through the first year because folks thought this peer assistance review program was so rigid. And basically what you had a PAR person who would come in and watch you and record you. And if you did not do well, some people say if you were not good at managing the class, you were out the first year, whatever. So I did fantastically well. She would say at the end, I was so nervous initially. And she was like, oh no, do you have teachers in your family? Do you, what? And what I was really doing was I was really listening to my kids and learning with them and then not really trying to judge how they were responding to me. And so I grew up in a family where they actually taught us how to take a fair amount of verbal abuse and jokes without getting so offended. And my kids always said things or they did things, and culturally I connect and I said, oh, I know. So I handled all my discipline inside the class. I didn't want to send my kids to the office because frankly, I just didn't understand what would happen to them. Like they would do something that, and I'd say, okay, that wasn't a smart thing. That was like mean. But I would say, okay, we're going to have detention. You're going to come in and do a lunch detention with me. And that's what we would do. That's how we would handle discipline. The other thing is I knew that they didn't want to be embarrassed. There were economic kids who had different socioeconomic levels, but I recognized it was so important for them to look a certain way in front of their peers. And so even when they challenged me in front of their peers and they said certain things and the kids were kind of like looking at, oh, what's Gooden going to do now? I'd be like, oh, okay, I can see that you're upset about that. And I would kind of go over and say, let's talk about it a little bit later. I would make a big deal out of it. And so there would just be the surprise that he didn't kick him out. Because they knew that that particular student had just been kicked out of the class before, the class that early that morning. And so I just wouldn't do that. And then when I would talk to the kid, they would kind of be sort of like appreciative that one, I didn't embarrass them because they would say things. Because I recognized also that middle schoolers, and if you know, Steve, you remember, in the morning, they may want to be an adult. But after lunch, they may want to be like 12 or 11 again. And then, you know, after lunch, you know, it's just all kinds of things going on with them, right? They're all over the place. So I didn't hold that against them. And so that gentleman I said that was actually one of the aides that worked with students with disabilities actually became a friend of mine, and we played chess frequently and at lunch. And the kids became interested. And so they'd be like, we want to kind of come by. We don't want to do detention, but we sort of want to just sit around y'all when y'all play chess. And so that became a point of pride for them. They became curious about that game. And I talked about how that could be a way of calming yourself and sort of reflecting on what you do before. And it was always these things that I was doing and picking up. And one of the things that my friend at the time who worked with students with disabilities, he reminded me that he would have kids who, you know, may have issues with behavior, who may come in one day and, you know, he said, I had a kid come in and tore up the class. And he said, but I always say to them, you know, if you come back tomorrow, because we really want them to come back, it's a new day. You can apologize and then you can have a clean slate. We're not going to hold that against you. You had a bad day, but you're not a bad kid. And so a number of those things I was incorporating all the time, recognizing that before I knew it, I was building community in my class and kids were wanting to show up there. And they still did silly things. They, you know, sometimes the jokes went too far. But for the most part, they wanted to be in the space with me. And I was learning that I wanted them to be there. And as a result of that, my PAR person who was reviewing, she was always like, wow, you just know how to do that. And I was learning as I went. But for her, it showed a remarkable degree of maturity for a first year teacher.
Hey, Mark, what's the connection then? Because as I was hearing, right, this middle school environment that you're creating as an educator, what was coming up really quickly was like, oh, early on, you actually started creating what you describe as these disruptive practices, even as a teacher. What's the connection to what you learned then to then these disruptive practices that you are now encouraging leaders to look at, right, to shift the whole status quo? What's the connection there?
Absolutely. So one of the things I recognize in workshops and teaching about racial equity, for instance, you're going to have people who are curious and interested. And we certainly encourage people to be curious, courageous, and committed to the work. But you're going to have folks who are suspicious, very reluctant to engage, right? And they're going to look at me as, I don't have a better way to say it, they're going to look at me as the enemy. They're going to look at me as the person who's bringing in this inappropriate topic that's very divisive. I have to own that and not take it personally. One of the agreements in the book is don't freeze people in time. And we don't do that, right? As people are trying to learn and speak their truth, that's a part of what they've learned from our larger collective systems. We've learned that you're not supposed to talk about race. And if you do, you're supposed to talk about it in a particular way and not very long. And by the way, it's more likely than not going to be the Black person bringing it up, or, you know, that Latino person. But it's not, they're the ones who make this an issue. And so feeling that resistance, sort of sitting with it, acknowledging it, but recognizing we can move beyond that. And so what I found is there are some ways that adults, like middle schoolers in that, they may say some things that they will likely regret later, but I'm not going to hold them to that, especially if we're in a space where we're trying to learn. Now, I'm not just talking about being irreverent and disrespectful to other adults, because I think adults know when they're doing that. But I think as people are learning, sometimes the language is not going to be where it needs to be, especially if we have not engaged in these kinds of conversations. So to your point, Jessica, I mean, I think it's an astute connection that you made. Yes, being okay in the moment and taking a deep breath as I present and engage with people and not having an emotional response. I've heard a lot of things. I've heard a lot of stuff. But people will often say, oh, you didn't seem to get angry. You didn't seem to have... And yeah, there are reactions going on inside, but I'm learning to say, stay in the moment so that we can amplify the learning versus me responding a certain way. And as you know, when you're the facilitator, people are watching very closely. Oh, what are you going to do now? Same thing with middle school. When some kid blew up and jumped, and they were like, oh, what's he going to do now? Oh, wow, he seems remarkably calm. He seems like this person still has a chance. Because I always say to teachers and leaders, kids have their own justice system operating. And a lot of times it has a lot to do with, you know, if you're looking at Malik and Malik has been suffering from injustices in general. Let's imagine Malik is a Black boy who his friends, they like Malik, but they know Malik can be mischievous. They're watching to see how you treat Malik in the class. If you're kind to Malik, you might be a kind person and you might be kind to me. If you are encouraging to Malik, who we all know he's having a hard time, then you're a person who is empathetic. You're a teacher who cares. And my kids cared a whole lot about whether you care, right? And if you did not, you know, they would say things to me about folks they just felt like just had no love for them. And you know, that's hard for me because I gotta, maybe so-and-so, this and so, but be mindful that I would always remind them that, yeah, that's a good point. I said, but you are gonna encounter people on your journey who are not only not going to care about you, but they're gonna have low expectations of you. You know, are you going to really give them pushback and prove them wrong by succeeding for you, not for them, for you?
I think by just, right, that theme of kind of staying present with them and the genuine act of caring, of loving, also makes you less vulnerable to perpetuate shallow solutions, right? Like, it's almost like you just can't do that when you genuinely stay present and genuinely love and care.
I agree. I heard a question, I guess I was on another podcast, and I was saying to people, in education, we know that there are some serious challenges, right? And there are things that we want to work on. But we also know that too often there are these solutions that are not right. And if we come with the canned solution to a problem or an issue that we don't understand, we come off as being, you know, disingenuous. But if we just say, you know, I have not gone through particular kinds of experiences, I don't understand what your issue is, but I want to listen. And I want to know what it is that you want from me. And so within the book, Practice 2 talks about and goes into this idea of really doing the work of engaging in powerful reflection. We start that chapter with engaging in a racial reflection. I think if people could do this in a way that is honest, authentic, and engaging, and genuinely curious, they will learn a lot about themselves, a lot about their what we call in the book, individual paradigms, right? Your individual mental models, your own values, your assumptions, and your beliefs. Once you learn more about those, you can see how those align with the collective paradigms, the systemic paradigm. If they align with who you are and where you are, and then you're going to feel some kind of discomfort and you're going to have privilege. But if there's any kind of misalignment with those collective systems, that's when you're going to start to feel like I, in some ways, don't belong. And so once we have had a chance, or once we've taken the opportunity, I should say, to engage in reflection through those different types of identities, we learn more about ourselves, and we learn that even in this issue of racial inequity, we stop saying or stop acting as if that's a thing that people of color are, it's about them, right? No, there are no disconnected histories. We didn't have enslaved people without having slavers. We have people who also, as slavers, ERS, benefited from slavery based on depriving people of their rights. It wasn't like they just had their own history around slavery. No, this is a connected history of the country of America, of the United States of America. And so once we come to understand that in our learning and our engaging around trying to break down inequitable systems, then we recognize we are all in this together, and we, in some ways, have benefited from this system, whether we are conscious of it or not. And it is our privilege and our rights to certain privileges that give us the opportunity to say, that's not my deal. I didn't have anything to do with that. I got in trouble a lot in graduate school with the debates we had because I would always say, well, you know, in the United States of America, we can't have a conversation about access and opportunity without going back to, as I was saying earlier, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Oh, no. The slavery, you know, men of my fellow white class, I didn't have anything to do with that. My grandfather didn't have. Why am I being held responsible? But you have lived in a country that has benefited you because you have identified or been allowed to identify with a white racial identity. That means that you have raked in some of those privileges. I don't care if you don't know about it or if you don't like it. It does not change the truth and the evidence that supports that reality.
That was a great segue to a big question of mine. Your book about the 5 practices for equity-focused school leadership that you co-wrote, and the one that really I was most interested in, I think maybe you just illustrated it a bit there, was the idea of cognitive dissonance. And I'm not trying to bring up big words for people to stumble over at all, but I think it's really crucial to understanding sort of all of our responsibilities to bring about a more equitable system. And if we don't understand that, I'm not sure where we can go. Can you help us with that, unpack that a bit?
I should say what I was talking about earlier, that's practice 2. I just said practice 2, but that is where you prepare yourself emotionally and intellectually to reflect, act, and repeat for equity every day. So practice 2 is really where you prepare yourself emotionally and intellectually to do the work. In terms of this idea of all of our responsibilities, the first practice that we talk about is prioritizing equity. And there's a wonderful pyramid in there that I've used many times in my work. If I can describe it, the base of that pyramid really has a historical foundation, right? And this is a pyramid where it's an illustration of inequity. And I want everybody to kind of get an understanding of, we all have a place in that historical inequity, right? These are things that have happened as a part of our history, and that we oftentimes erroneously think that they're locked into the past somewhere and they have nothing to do with what we're doing today. You know, case in point, I talked about Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. Brown hasn't disappeared. It made it illegal, right, to segregate kids. But do we still have kids who are segregated by race in school? Yes, we do. Connected to that, the next layer up, think about this idea of structural. We have structures in place that have made that reality from Brown, even the undesirable aspects of it, continue now to today, right? If I move it up one more level, we got institutional. We got laws. We got policies. We got practices that do the same thing. We have things that we have implemented, or somebody implemented before us, they make absolutely no sense at all, except that they maintain particular kinds of inequities and we enforce them without interrogating them. So going back to your point about cognitive dissonance, is that we see these things and they happen and we know what should be happening, right? But then we have this sort of this view that, wow, it doesn't align as well. What I'm looking at and what's happening around inequities, I haven't had a chance to really break them down and look through all of the pieces. So I experienced this sort of, even a matter of disequilibrium around what it means when I hear things like racial inequities or race or racism. And I think that even the term race and racist, which is what people hear when we start talking about this kind of language, or people get worried about, or trying to protect myself from being a bad person. And I should be clear, a lot of our white colleagues start to feel in that way, and that we don't want to engage. They're reluctant to engage in these conversations. And so that pyramid gives people a space to see actual inequities so that we can see them and start to peel them apart. And then last but not least, at the top of that pyramid, there's a smaller triangle that talks about these interpersonal inequities, but these interpersonal ways of engaging. And what we find is we're more afraid about what will happen because of these interpersonal interactions with each other. It's the place where we try to talk about this, and people are afraid that I may say the wrong thing, or I may end up on the 6 o'clock news, and I don't want to be like that person who said something and spilled out of their mouth. And those are the things that are socially unacceptable, right? And in the book, I say that right above that, the interpersonal is the socially unacceptable stuff. But the bottom of that horizontal line are those three pieces I've just said: historical, structural, and institutional. And those all tend to be socially acceptable ways of perpetuating inequity. And if we're not really interrogating those and pulling those pieces apart and talking about them every day and how they impact the work that we're doing in schools, there's a high likelihood that we are, in fact, perpetuating a system that systematically excludes folks who have been historically oppressed. And I hope that hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, that is helpful. And I just want to follow that up with, you know, Jessica and I, knowing our audience, and many of them are want a practical thing to do, or practical thing to read or to think about. And one of your favorite books turns out to be a book I had to read three times to get it. It was beautifully written, Isabel Wilkerson's Caste.
Oh, yeah.
And it reminds me of what you were just talking about, the need, and the base of your pyramid is this need to understand the history.
Yes.
I can't think of a more beautiful book and written more graciously to understand history in a meaningful way for teachers. Can you just maybe talk a bit about that book and why it was influential to you, just as one possible thing for people to read that is meaningful in this conversation?
Yeah, I really like the way that Ms. Wilkerson writes. And I think you said it summed it up quite nicely. What's so compelling about the book is she reminds us, you know, using I believe the metaphor of a house, right? How we have to have this connection to this foundational history in this country, and recognize that things that are happening today, they still have connections to where we are. And not just on a national level, right? Which is really interesting, because she presents ideas of what we were talking about in America about inequality and inequities around eugenics. You know, that was, she makes these bold statements about how that was adopted by the Nazis as, hey, this is a way that we can promote this stuff and then do some real damage to people. Because if we can look at those folks and make them less than human, then we can be less concerned about what we do with them, because after all, they're not humans anyway. But this has an eerie parallel to how we have thought about African Americans in this country, right? And I say historically, because lest we forget, African American people are still being brutalized, right? Still are disproportionately represented in the prison system. Still, African American children are disproportionately suspended from schools. Right. I know there's some theoreticians say, oh, well, you know, there's not really a school to prison pipeline per se, but there's a high correlation between kids not being in school and being excluded from the community and then finding themselves in places that they shouldn't be, or that really can adversely affect their future. So I just love the way she talks about this caste system And there's so many nice connections. She talks about Dr. King going to India and really, you know, being somewhat offended when they was like, you know, no, you're not the lower caste, right? And he said, whoa, whoa. You know? And I could just see, you know, which I love, again, Dr. King's one of my great favorite writers, how he reflects on things and writes about it, right? And just say, you know, wait a minute, this is just kind of a point. And sort of taking this back and thinking, wow, wow. You know, we're stuck in this kind of caste of inequality. And one pyramid that I've used also in my work is this thing, which Isabel talks about as well, this racial hierarchy. We can say all day long that we thought about and conceived of this country. And I always say and remind people that racism came before race. Because people wanted to oppress folks for economics in this country, who happened to be African Americans, they came up with race. Because they wanted to be racist, they say, we're going to make a lot of this thing about race, which we all know by now, I should say, remind your listeners, you know, that there's no real biological basis to this thing that's socially defined as race. It's socially constructed, which means it's made up. But it has very real implications for the lives of people. And so Ms. Wilkerson's book, Caste, talks about what it means to put people in certain categories and to look at them and to look down on them and use that as the collective paradigm and think about what that means to your self-esteem, right? It doesn't mean that we don't have Black people who don't push against that and push through and who succeed. But by and large, there are so many of us, not just in our imagination, who have been really economically put in these situations that are very, very difficult. And have limited opportunities when we come back to the education system, because it too has been built on such a dramatic system of inequities. Because we know, if we're honest about public education as a public good and the quality of it in terms of resources, not talking about the teachers necessarily. You can still have good teachers who work in school that have limited resources, but in terms of the resources and the access and the structural and institutional realities, the quality of your education in that sense is still highly, highly correlated with property rights. And just to be clear for folks, so folks understand, that means like the more house you can afford in America, for instance, the better your school system will be. And you know, we don't have time to get into all of that, but you know, suffice it to say, that definitely is inequities happening when we recognize that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. I just want to hit pause. We're past our time, Dr. Gooden. We have kept you longer, and I apologize for that, but I just couldn't stop listening.
I hope I didn't talk too much there. Yeah.
No. Oh my gosh. No, I was like, let's just make this a 2-hour episode. Can we do that? I'm really grateful that you joined us, Steve and I. Well, I actually don't call you Steve that much. Grainer and I were really looking forward to having this conversation with you. And oh, it was so enlightening. And there's just so much that I need to reflect on. So thank you for that.
I see you as a great combination between speaking to leadership, but also having lived in the middle school and done the work from leaving inside the dough. So those two things just kind of hit me in a way.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that, Steve. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that was well said, Grainer. Well, thank you, Dr. Gooden. We appreciate your time. You are doing phenomenal work. I'm grateful that you are doing that work and changing the system. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you both for inviting me. It was a true pleasure.
I'm KJ Royalty, the Lindbergh Senior High Student Intern who edited this episode. Education Suspended is a production of Intricate Roots Educational Consulting Services. Our producer is Jessica Pfeiffer. Our Educational Suspended website is created by Grainer Media. Our production manager is Gina Hansen, and our music provided by Poets Row.